It is said that change is afoot within the American electorate, not the sort of change which many of us expected. This change, so it goes, positively benefits the Republican Party because more minorities are headed towards it. Something else, to say the least, whether or not it pans out is a question, and we are here tonight to address this very important matter. I am joined by the one, the only, Paul Godfrey, the man who needs no introduction. Of course, I am Joseph Cotto, the host of NewsSite. Paul, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You are in a bit of discomfort due to issues, shall we say. But the fact of the matter is you have weathered the storm and you indeed are alive, and that counts for quite a bit.
Well, perhaps I should explain. I had hernia surgery 4.5 days ago. So I'm still a little bit sore, and I'm not, as I said, dressed as elegantly as I should be. I really don't see it as a kind of, you know, life and death issue. It was probably elective surgery, and I can't elect against it at this point. It's too late.
Well, unfortunately, there are quite a few people who would be rooting for your demise, and you once again have aggravated them in the best sort of way.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. I mean, and they're probably very disappointed, you know, to see my comeback so rapidly.
Well, I'm very glad to be contributing to that comeback. And of course, for those who don't know, Paul Godfrey is a towering figure on the American intellectual scene. So he has such a shadow that people try to block him out. That's probably the best way of describing him. He is one of our time's most interesting political theorists. He's a man, like I said, who needs no introduction, but just in case you do need an introduction for him, he is the editor-in-chief of Chronicles, and he is the emeritus professor, I believe, the Horace Raffensperger Emeritus Professor of Humanities at Elizabethtown College, and his work, particularly with regard to paleoconservatism, is unparalleled. He is something else, to say the absolute least. And many people say great more than that, but of course, I speak of Paul positively, and I wish more people did.
Well, thank you very much. I also am a Guggenheim recipient from 1984, and I obtained the Guggenheim working at a small college. Small, obscure Midwestern college. There I wrote my book on the search for historical meaning, which was really an overview of the conservative movement and the European influences on it.
And of course, I mean, as if all of this were not enough, Paul also served in the Reagan administration. So, I mean, we really have, you're also a delegate for Reagan in 1980 at the RNC, I believe.
Alternate delegate.
Alternate
I didn't have to go.
Got it. So, but anyway, Paul has done quite a lot, and he brings a great deal to the table to address this very curious issue of racial demographics in American politics. I will get into the subject matter, and then Paul will share his far more interesting views. Now, American politics, they are at a crossroads. There is a significant racial realignment that could reshape the landscape for many years to come. In a recent New York Times poll, Joe Biden's lead over Donald Trump among non-white Americans shrunk to a mere 56% to 44%, which is in stark contrast to the nearly 50-point margin Joe Biden enjoyed in 2020. So essentially, his 50-point margin has shrunk to a 12-point margin. This erosion of support among minority voters represents a troubling trend for Democrats, signaling a decline more rapid in this demographic than any other. That's really interesting because typically you think of whites supporting the Republican Party, and certainly the Democrats have been losing whites on the whole, but they're losing minorities now quicker than they're losing whites. Tremendously important for the future. While these statistics might initially be met with skepticism, to say the least, the evidence is compelling, and it is supported by data from reputable national election surveys, indicating that the Democratic advantage among Black, Hispanic, and Asian voters is currently at its lowest point since 1960. Gallup polls confirm this downward trajectory, painting a picture of a party losing its grip on a crucial segment of the electorate. Now, Paul, I really want to get into this more, but anything to say about what I just brought up?
Yeah, I mean, I've read the same reports, but I think if you examine the demographics more carefully, you find that the Republicans have gained enormously among Hispanics. And right now, Trump has a 6 to 7 point lead over Biden among this group. And many of these people, of course, have been impacted by this open southern border, which is being used for one purpose only, obviously, to create a larger Democratic majority. And, you know, have a kind of imaginary past in which they keep on talking about the Democrats as a racist party because the Democrats did such things as support the crime bill in 1994, which was bipartisan. And they also opposed busing for racial integration, which everyone but the extreme left did. And this now indicates the Democrats were racist. They did exactly what the Republicans did at the time. But the efforts by Republican media and politicians to play up, you know, their anti-racism, their support of Blacks, their utter loathing for Southern conservatives who may have been segregationists at one time, I don't think has really given them very much. I was looking at a Gallup poll of Biden's popularity, relative popularity among various groups. Among Hispanics and whites, he is deep in the tank. Among Blacks, he leads Trump 54% to 12% in terms of popularity. I really don't see this massive Black surge into the Republican Party. I'd like to be proven wrong. I doubt that I will. You know, I mean, it's possible that 12 or 13% of Blacks may vote for the Republican Party in the next election. I don't expect any kind of massive influx of Blacks. Nothing comparable to what is happening among Hispanics. And I think one of the things I've argued is a lot of wasted effort by Republicans, virtue signaling, all kinds of nonsense to appeal to Black votes. I think the energy and the resources should be used to go after groups that demographics that are known to support the Republicans, where you have proven success, or where in the case of the Hispanics, you can show an enormous increase in support. I see nothing like that among Blacks.
What about, I mean, we'll get into the Hispanics momentarily, and then I'll return to my monologue, if you will. But what about the Oriental vote? Because it looks like quite a few Orientals, and I define them as East Asians, are moving towards the GOP. And it also looks like there is, however, counterintuitively, a slippage of some Middle Easterners who are considered white in the U.S., but a lot of people don't think they are, which is, you know, their issue, whatever. But not a lot of them, but some of them, counterintuitively, are becoming more Republican. So it's interesting. That's not just the Hispanics, even if the Black shift to the GOP is overstated. So, Paul, what do you think about the Orientals, the Middle Easterners?
I think you're right. No, I mean, there's definitely a shift there. You know, the Far Eastern vote, wherever. I don't know about the Indian vote. I think that's still pretty solidly Democratic, though I could be wrong. But certainly the Filipino, the Chinese were historically Republican. Japanese not so much. The Japanese may also change and become Republican. You know, the Arab vote was largely Republican, then they moved to the Democratic camp. And I think it's because the Republicans were so strongly pro-Israel, Republicans sort of fell between two stools. They did not pick up much more Jewish support than they had, but they lost Arab support. And now the Arabs, I think, they may not vote, certainly the ones in Michigan, we have large numbers around Detroit, they may not vote for the Republican Party, but probably more will stay home and simply not vote in the next presidential race rather than vote for Biden, who is seen as too soft on Israel.
That is interesting how the Arab, it's really the Muslim population in Michigan will vote, because a lot of its members are very angry with Joe Biden. He had an uncommitted vote in the Democratic primary that was 10 times what was expected. So about 10 times, obviously it's a rough estimation. So it's really something else that there is this level of discord among voters who become very, very loyal Democrats over the years. And the Arab vote has gone more Democratic due to, I think, the backlash to George W. Bush post 9/11, which was in tandem with the Arab vote here becoming more Muslim, because traditionally the Arab vote in the U.S. was overwhelmingly, almost totally Christian. So it's interesting to see how that has changed. Then, of course, there's the question of the Indians, the subcontinental Indians, of course. And Paul brings up an interesting question of how they'll vote. He does not know if there'll be much change, obviously. I do definitely see a shift in energy amongst subcontinental Indians in terms of their activism within the GOP. A few years back, unfortunately, one did not see much of anything at all coming from their corner, but now one sees a hell of a lot. As a matter of fact, in this last GOP presidential primary cycle, two of the candidates, to the extent there were any real candidates aside from Trump, two of the candidates were themselves subcontinental Indian, one a Sikh, one a Hindu. So it's something else that there is this rise, at least in Indian activism within the GOP. I think that will continue. I think you see Tulsi Gabbard shift, however unofficially, towards the Republican ranks as further evidence of this, because she's a very strong Hindu activist. So this is really an interesting subject matter, to say the least.
No, I think you're right. I think in the case of Vivek Ramaswamy, he like went out of his way to indicate his great love and affection for Christians and to say his own Hinduism is not very different from Christianity, you know, and have respect for both. I think on the other hand, I think his Haley actually went in the other direction, that, you know, she really had marketed or branded herself an evangelical Christian for years, and now she has rediscovered her Sikh roots. And they don't know whether that's very useful in the Republican Party. I think the way Vivek has moved, you know, even without abandoning this Hinduism, toward, you know, a kind of rapprochement with Christianity probably works much better if you want to be a Republican.
Yeah, what's interesting, what a lot of people don't get, is that a lot of Republican voters, I'm not just talking about Rockefeller Republicans like myself who live in a coastal state. I live in the only bi-coastal state, so I'm as coastal as it gets. But if you talk about like Republican hardcore base voters out in middle America, they don't spurn people because they're racial minorities. They're not going to harass someone because he is a Hindu either. A lot of these people are very receptive towards those who are not similar to them, if these people are respectful and if they generally share the same value system.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. The evangelical Republicans are much more tolerant than the Democratic atheist. I mean, and they seem to have a certain appreciation or empathy for people of other religions, as long as those people of other religions emphasize the similarities between what they believe and what the Christians, these Protestant Christians, believe.
I think it's a respect thing more than anything else, because the people who are out in flyover country, they're used to being disrespected at every turn by people who even might share their religion, people who might be fellow Republicans, let alone, you know, secular Democrats. These flyover country folks, they're so used to being maligned that if somebody treats them with some degree of respect, they're very amenable to them.
No, I agree. I mean, they're they're looking for allies desperately, whereas the coastal elites, you know, can be as intolerant as they want because they have so much power and they control the media and universities. So the people in flyover country cannot be as critical of those, you know, who want to live in peace with them. But I think that they're all, because they are theists and because they do have a belief in a higher being, they generally seem to be sympathetic to other people who share that belief, even if they do not necessarily share the same Christian dogmas.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a general sympathy there. I will say that the flyover country folks have never done anything bad to me, at least insofar as I can tell. And I'm a secular humanist from a Jewish perspective, so they are definitely the flyover people. I have no ill will towards them, to say the least. Anyway, getting back to my monologue here, which of course, you know, Paul's commentary and comparison is so much more interesting, but I've just got to get to some data. Of course, I disagree. Anything Paul says is more interesting than me. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. But anyway, several factors contribute to the seismic shift going on in American politics, which is to say the minorities becoming more Republican. Firstly, the fading memories of historical struggles and weakening ties to the Democratic Party among younger generations are undeniable, mm-hmm. while older Black Americans who experienced the civil rights era remain staunch supporters of the Democrats, their children and grandchildren are increasingly questioning their allegiance. Additionally, the traditional correlation between income and political affiliation is waning, with the GOP shedding its image of the parties of wealthy elites, thus appealing to more working and middle-class voters across racial lines. However, perhaps the most significant revelation is the revelation that many non-white voters in America have held conservative views far more aligned with the Republican Party than previously thought. Contrary to popular belief, the migration away from the Democrats is not merely disillusionment among natural supporters, but a realization among natural Republicans that they have been backing the wrong party all along. Now, Paul, I'm going to get into a bit more here, but this obviously is it's some consequential stuff. Any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I don't agree. No, I mean, I heard this on Fox News, you know, Laura Ingraham and others. I'm from Missouri in the sense that you have to show me that this works for the Blacks. Inner city Blacks are overwhelmingly Democratic, and their needs are served if the if those they vote for attack white racism, and promise to treat more leniently Blacks, even Black criminals. These are important issues for inner city Black, and the inner cities contain a very large part of the Black population. I don't think the inhabitants of Houston who vote for what's her name, Sheila Jackson Lee, the other way around, or that lady from St. Louis, Cori Bush. I don't think these people are going to change their votes. And as I said, if you look at the relative degrees of popularity of Biden and Trump among Blacks, Biden is much more preferred by most Blacks than Trump. And you hear this every 4 years that, you know, Blacks should be on our side, and that usually it's accompanied by silly stuff about how the Democrats are the party of racism, as presented very unconvincingly by Mark Levin on his program every week, usually twice a week. I really don't think Blacks care about this at all. Blacks have been Democrats since 1936. You know, when they switched parties, they've been Republicans before. And they don't seem they don't seem ready to change. I know the story. The younger ones will think differently. My question is, which younger ones? The ones who go to college are usually indoctrinated with leftist propaganda. The inner city Blacks who hang out on the street corners don't, you know, I doubt they're going to vote Republican. They may not vote at all. I don't know where this enormous influx of younger Blacks into the Republican Party is supposed to be coming from. And I mean, they always introduce these people on, you would always pull out somebody in Fox News, you know, you're dealing with tens of millions of people, so you can find some of them will vote. But again, should we generalize, I'd be very happy to vote for Mark Robinson for governor of North Carolina, but I do not, he's a very, very conservative Christian pastor, but I doubt he is typical. I doubt Byron Donalds is typical of black voters or black politicians in the United States. So you're going to have to convince me, as I said in an article that I wrote today for The Blaze, you're going to have to convince me that these changes are taking place, because I hear them all the time, where this is always about to happen. And, you know, 2 years ago, I was told that blacks in New York City were going to rush to vote for Lee Zeldin against this horrible woman, Hochul, because blacks are concerned about crime. Guess what? They voted overwhelmingly for Hochul against Lee Zeldin. And, you know, my point is, why would I not believe this is going to happen again this year?
Very good question. And I mean, obviously, we have to wait to see what happens this year. But no, the black vote, I know, because I follow data relevant to it. And I listen to quite a few black independent media sources, content creators, when they call them online. And there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the Democrats, which does not necessarily translate into satisfaction with the Republicans. Right. As a matter of fact, it rarely does. What I think will happen is that there simply will not be a big black turnout for Joe Biden. And the biggest issue that I can see is immigration. A lot of blacks feel that they are being replaced because the illegals go to densely populated, economically downscale urban environments, and black Americans disproportionately live in these areas. And they see the immigrants, illegal aliens, coming there and receiving help from the government that the blacks do not get. And they are very angry about this. And they also are fearful of amnesty for the illegals, which is to say a pathway to citizenship, because these black voters think, well, you know, these folks, once they get their citizenship, they're going to be outnumbering us and outvoting our interests. So there is real concern among many blacks, particularly younger ones, those under age 50, about the Democratic Party representing their interests. It used to be that the Republicans were thought of as the party of anti-black interests, but now it's being thought that the Democrats are importing a new electorate so they can become the party of anti-black interests. Anything to say about this, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think you may be right. The turnout for Biden will be among blacks will be smaller than it was in 2020. I've no doubt of that. Whether blacks turn out to vote Republican, of course, is another question. I would also point to the election of Letitia James as attorney general in New York State. Blacks heavily supported her. She won statewide 55% of the vote running her second term 2 years ago. And I mean, the black vote was like over 90% for her. She ran basically on one issue, destroying Donald Trump. I mean, if she had anything else, I don't know what it is, but it was destroying Donald Trump. That was her issue. And obviously, this was appealing to a lot of black people. Zeldin's emphasis on fighting crime did not do very well among blacks. They probably thought this was a racist position that would be directed against them. So I'm very skeptical about, you know, large black turnouts for the Republican Party, although I do agree with you that the turnout for Biden is not going to be as great as it was in 2020.
Actually, if one looks at the numbers, the black turnout for the Democrats has been going down every election cycle after 2012. So it's really intriguing. So there's been disillusionment within that community with the Democrats for some time. And I expect it to continue. I think there's another angle here which is overlooked. There are more and more West Indian blacks and sub-Saharan African immigrants within the American black community, and they do not have the ancestral ties to the Democratic Party, which American blacks do. So if these West Indian West Indians, more broadly speaking, Caribbean. So these Caribbean blacks, or when these sub-Saharan African immigrants vote, they don't have it in their minds that, well, the Democrats are necessarily the party of my group. Now, of course, a lot of these
these blacks who come from immigrant groups, they vote Democratic overwhelmingly, but the intensity of support, the emotional tie to the party itself simply is not there. And it means that these individuals are easier for the GOP to appeal to than the traditional, one might say, Afro-American community.
Yeah, I think you're right. One of my major gripes with Republicans reaching out to blacks is how ridiculous they sound. You know, that all the blacks are coming home, they're all going to vote for us this year. And of course, they don't. And then, Democrats like Biden, they associated with segregationists. Well, I mean, how many, all those Southern Democrats were segregationists, right? Both Republicans and Democrats dealt with them. The Republicans did absolutely nothing when they pulled down the monument for reconciliation of the Civil War put up by Moses Ezekiel, one of your fellow Sephardic Jews from the South. It was offensive because they had some little Confederate thing there together with the Union. I mean, many blacks too, but it made no difference. Republicans would not stand up for that monument, which was the most impressive monument, one of the most impressive monuments in Arlington. When they pulled on Robert E. Lee's statue, they were fine with that. But they're basically looking at, they somehow imagine that the more they humiliate the Confederacy or Southern whites, the more blacks are going to scream into their party, or the more they lie about, you know, the 1994 crime bill or the busing for integration, all the blacks are going to like them. I can't imagine them even caring. But these are Republican gestures, like throwing under the bus Southern white conservatives, doing nothing for them, taking positions that would have put them to the left of either party, you know, on busing for integration. There are ways that you can appeal to, you can appeal on economic grounds. You're going to do better. You'll get more jobs. I mean, they do this too, and I think that's fine. But the attempt to humiliate all white Democrats before a certain date, or humiliate all humiliate Southern whites, or take extreme leftist positions on issues in the past, I think it's ridiculous. I think it does nothing to win black votes. And the most ridiculous thing is every election cycle, we're told all these blacks are going to vote for the Republican, and they don't. You know, and then someone has to explain it away, or we got 1 or 2 more percent. And my view for a long time is, you know, appeal to all voters if you can, but know that you have certain demographics that are likely to vote for you, and see if you can maximize the number there who are going to vote for you. And in the case of the Hispanics, you have a gold mine. They're all coming in. You know, so this is the group you should be appealing to much more than the blacks, because you're much more successful. And of course, the people, the Chinese, the Japanese, others from the Far East, they're coming into the party. And if there are specific black demographics, like the Nigerians or who are going to vote for you, you appeal specifically to them. But every time the Republicans seem to reach out, they fall on their faces. They make fools of themselves, and they don't pick up black votes very well.
They do a terrible job of appealing to blacks. Everybody knows that. That the GOP gets any black support is something done arguably in spite of the Republican Party itself. That's no secret. I think that it's really interesting to see where this goes, because I think the GOP should focus on building, generally speaking, with the Caribbean blacks and with the sub-Saharan African immigrants, and to a lesser extent, really make a sincere anti-illegal alien appeal to inner city Afro-Americans. That would be the way to do it from my point of view. Of course, I'm not a Republican strategist, but that's what I would do if indeed I were one. And there's a hell of a lot of progress to be made with virtually every other minority group, especially the Orientals, the Middle Easterners, even though they're considered white in America, and even looking at, in addition to, you know, the subcontinental Indians, the Southeast Asians. I mean, there's fertile ground here for Republican growth, no question. But one place where there has been astonishing growth for the GOP is in the Hispanic column. This is really just over the last few years, despite the fact that we were told Trump, you know, is going to drive all Hispanics away once and for all, blah, blah, blah. So why do you think the GOP has been doing so better with the Hispanic community? This, of course, is counterintuitive, but it sure is true.
Yeah, no, I think there has been a recognition by Hispanics who do not bring the grievances that blacks do, you know, or Afro-Americans do, although not Nigerians or necessarily Caribbeans, but they don't bring the grievances of somebody's other of the Afro-American community, so-called Afro-Americans. So I think that they're easier to recruit. Also, the Republican social position, they're much more compatible with what Hispanics believe. So, you know, it's not really that hard to sell. I think in the case of reaching out to Nigerians and Caribbeans, one advantage of that is you don't have to yap all the time about the sins of slavery and segregation and we're atoning it, because they never went through this, right? So you don't have to give them any of this. You can simply, you know, point out the advantages of voting for your party. I'm not sure you pick up many Afro-American votes, you know, the Republicans, by doing this either, by doing the song and dance and bleeding all over the floor, you know, about racism and how we used to be racist, but now we're better and so forth. You don't have to do any of this. What you do is you simply appeal to people's interest. It is in your, if you're concerned with crime, you're concerned with more jobs and so forth, you vote for our party. And I mean, the values issue may come up if you're appealing to evangelical Christians, right? Or you know, sort of core groups that are culturally conservative. But some of the other groups you're trying to reach out to, particularly these non Afro American blacks, I think economic issues are fine. And economic issues also work for Hispanics and for the people from the Far East. One of the things that obviously has benefited Republicans is the Democrats have practiced anti-Asian racism. Jobs, DEI, all this other stuff has impacted Asians. It's also impacted people from the Indian subcontinent, but I think convincing them may take a longer time than the people from the Far East. I think the subcontinent Indians seem to have a very strong tie, most of them do, the Democratic Party by now. And if you look at representatives, I mean, they have, you know, very radical Indian representatives. There's one from California, a Democrat, I was seeing him interviewed, and he's...
Ro Khanna?
Right, he's not like Ocasio-Cortez or even worse, although Brett Baer assures me he wants common ground of some kind. But on all social issues and things like that, he's very far on the left. And he does very, very well among subcontinental Indian voters.
Yeah, it's interesting because there is a split within their community. I live in an area that has a very large subcontinental Indian population. Mm-hmm. And here, I most of the energy within it definitely is Republican, but there is some diversity. Mm-hmm. Of course, interestingly, the younger ones tend to be more likely to vote Republican than the older mm-hmm. ones. So it's something else. But there is a massive... population of subcontinental Indians in America who vote Democratic and who are loyal to the Democratic Party. Although I do think that there is some change on that horizon. Exactly how far it goes is anyone's guess, but I do see the change. It's interesting, to say the least, and very consequential for the coming years in American politics. Now, getting back to my monologue, researchers Ismail K. White and Sheryl and Laird's groundbreaking work in their 2020 book, Steadfast Democrats, sheds light on the phenomenon of minority Democrats being more conservative than one would imagine because of their partisan affiliation. There is a disparity between the policy preferences of many Black Americans and their voting patterns. Conservative positions on issues such as gun rights and limited government intervention, traditionally associated with the GOP, resonate strongly with a significant portion of non-white conservatives, challenging the notion of a monolithic Democratic voting bloc. Historically, social networks have played a crucial role in reinforcing party allegiances among non-white conservatives. Those embedded in racially homogenous communities tend to maintain support for Democrats, while exposure to more diverse social circles weakened these norms and facilitated a shift towards the GOP. I find that to be especially fascinating. This pattern mirrors the dynamics observed in Britain's Red Wall, where conservative-leaning communities eventually embraced the Conservative Party after years of feeling alienated. This is something else, Paul. It really is, because it goes to show how what's going on here has already taken place elsewhere. So it's really not an all-American phenomenon. It's something seen perhaps, you could say, throughout the Western world or certainly within the Anglosphere. It's intriguing, put mildly. Anything to say?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely correct. One of the things that I've noticed is that people with intense ethnic loyalties and ethnic solidarity who move from non-Western into Western societies almost invariably support the multicultural left. You know, it's an expression of their own national solidarity and, you know, in a sense of the collective we against the collective they, the people on the outside. So, you see, you know, they're being inconsistent because, you know, they believe in a patriarchal society where, you know, the arranged marriages and so forth, but they vote for transgendered something, or, you know, cultural radicals in German elections or French elections or whatever. In their mind, they're perfectly consistent. I was told a story about having a Hindu colleague when I worked at Rockford College many years ago, and his wife and daughters walked behind him. And it was a traditional Hindu patriarch. And I was an alternate delegate for Reagan. So I asked him, his name was Professor Rao. I give his name, I doubt he's alive anymore. He's like 30 years older than I am now. I said, of course you're going to vote for Reagan because you're a very traditional Hindu. He says, no, I'm not. He says, he was against the Equal Rights Amendment. And I understood that. That was not inconsistent. It is, if I vote for this Gentile over here, I want him to be a radical leftist. Otherwise, he will threaten my community because he's an outsider. So there is a double standard. You know, nobody makes any bones about this. Like all those people in Houston and elsewhere running, you know, to honor Modi, who is the head of the Indian government and is a Hindu nationalist. They overwhelmingly vote for the left in the United States because, you know, it is, the United States is not their nation. Or their ethnic group, you know, they're the outsider. And one might say, you know, voting for the left when it comes to the outsider, right, or the person who's not part of your group is a conservative act, because it's, you know, it sort of preserves your group against the outsider. So I think that identifying yourself as part of the outside group is the process by which the conservatism that you exhibit in your own community, you know, is then becomes more general. You know, it is extended to the, what until then had been the outside group, of which you now feel part.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it, and I think it holds a great deal of water. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a bit of a hypocritical element there, but it makes sense in the context which you describe. Now, getting back to my monologue as it winds down, as America becomes less racially segregated, the barriers preventing non-white conservatives from aligning with the Republican Party diminish. The self-reinforcing process described by Republican pollster Patrick Ruffini as a preference cascade further undermines the stigma associated with Republican affiliation within minority communities fueling a momentum that could reshape electoral outcomes. While some may view these shifts as temporary or expect former Democratic voters to become swing voters rather than solid Republicans, the left's challenge with non-white voters runs deeper. A less racially divided America fosters a political landscape where ideology outweighs identity, posing a significant challenge to the Democratic Party's traditional stronghold. This, I think, is especially important because obviously, when people have a more, to be blunt, ghettoized view of themselves in relation to society, they're going to be voting for the party that's perceived as supporting their group, irrespective of what their individual interests might be. If people feel more assimilated, then they will vote more based on issues. But the question in my mind is this: what are they assimilating to? Because America no longer has a common culture, shared identity, not even a mutually spoken language from sea to shining sea. So since there is no such thing as a unifying American society, basically, what is it that an immigrant group will assimilate to? That determines, I think, their politics more than anything else. If you have, say, Druze, Paul and I know what Druze are, a unique ethno-religious group from the Middle East, particularly northern Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. If you have Druze who grow up in suburban Oklahoma City, there is a chance, a very good chance, that they will wind up voting Republican as they become more acclimated to American, to their segment, to the American society which exists in suburban Oklahoma City. On the other hand, if you have Druze from the same, you know, area, we'll just say it could be Israel, Syria, Lebanon, whatever, who go to Manhattan, they're probably almost certainly going to be voting more leftward than they would have otherwise, as they become more assimilated to the segment of America which predates their presence. So it's really this unique dynamic, I think, that will determine how people vote. But for sure, they'll become more conscious of issues that impact the individual as opposed to group-based politicking.
Yeah, I think, though, there is an ideology that unites the left. It's wokeism. Black Lives Matter, LGBT and so forth. These are all elements of what I call the post-Marxist leftist ideology. And racial minorities, or blacks specifically, not all racial minorities, because obviously Asians don't count, and Hispanics count less and less. But, you know, blacks are the victim group around which you sort of organize it yourself and, you know, call for compensation, redistribution of income. So I mean, they serve a great instrumental value within the promotion of this ideology and the people who identify with it. The other point that you raise is sort of interesting. What can you assimilate into? And there was this controversy about 20 years ago with all the Turks coming and the other Muslims coming into Germany, particularly in Berlin. What exactly are they going to assimilate into, since being German is evil and fascist and the Germans are doing everything they can to de-Germanize themselves? So the answer was the die Türken des von Bussen unser Schuldbewusstsein teilen. They have to share our Schuldbewusstsein, our sense of guilt as Germans. Once they buy into our guilt, they can become Germans. They can, you know, atone for every war that Germany started or was supposed to have started. They can hate themselves as Germans. They can share the masochism, you know, of the dominant culture. But obviously, there's nothing positive these people can assimilate into. And I think the United States is sort of moving in that direction, but there seems to be a kind of vacillation. If you listen to our head of government, our titular head of government, who, of course, is senile and demented, but he'll tell you that, "I'm proud to be, America's great. This is, I'm so proud to be an American." Then his next speech, he tells you that, you know, all white Americans are guilty of systemic racism, except for the ones who vote for him. And we have to atone for this and give money to DEI and so forth. So there does seem to be sort of almost a kind of schizophrenia about identifying as Americans. But I think you're generally, it's sort of harder and harder to find this common core. For the Republicans, it's something like the Declaration of Independence, particularly the the passage about all of us being created equal and having been endowed with certain rights. It's again and again on Fox News. But you need something more than a proposition, right, to hold together a nation. If you want to have a nation, we want a national culture. So I think this does remain a problem in getting these people, you know, to assimilate. I'm not so sure, though, you cannot, you know, the people from the subcontinent of India cannot remain Indians, they can't do, and yet be Republicans. I think this is possible.
Absolutely.
But I think what has to be shed and what is basic to democratic identity is victimology. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to say that I want to be treated like other people in this country. I have the same rights, the same duties. I should not be given affirmative action, compensatory justice, because this is the way the Democrats govern, and very effectively. And they may have a majority of the country on their side by now, you know, because they have enough victim groups and give them enough special favors as victims and so forth. So I think that getting beyond this is much more. I mean, you could still, you know, identify with whatever you are. You can be a Hasidic Jew or an Indian Hindu or whatever. But you have to understand that you do not have other rights because of your ethnic identity or because of your victim status that should not be given to Americans who do not belong to your group. So I think that is basic. And of course, the Democrats have so corrupted the American polity by doing this, and they are not going to stop doing it because it's a winning hand by now that they're holding. And that, I think, is the real problem, that, you know, there are enough groups they can buy off by pretending they're victims. Even if the blacks and the gays remain the, you know, the top victims. But there's enough victimology to go around.
A lot of blacks in the Democratic Party would say they no longer have this top victimhood status within the hierarchy that it's been replaced by others, particularly the trans movement. And interestingly, many gays would say the same thing. So it's really the problem with this whole intersectionality coalition of the Democrats is that for all the strength it has in motivating votes based upon hatred for Norman Rockwell's America, you wind up having different classes of victims whose victimhood status results in a privilege that can be rescinded. And then there is a sort of perverse form of class conflict wherein one class of victim doesn't have the same benefits as another class, and they go at loggerheads. And it just goes to show how insane this whole thing is. But this is definitely a very real drawback of the Democrats' intersectionality coalition.
You know, I think it is, but it is sort of, it is held together. And generally, we accept the fact that blacks and gays are probably the highest victims, and women. I think there is a hierarchy, and people generally are accepting of it. And you can see this hierarchy if you turn on your TV set and see what brainwashing you're getting at a particular day, you know, thanks to Hollywood and the scriptwriters and corporate capitalist wokesters and so forth. But there are certain blacks, definitely, I think, have the best hand or the best card. And maybe gays or second women, but they sort of accept this as long as benefits continue to come. But I am intrigued by the way they can make this game go on. You think that they'd all be clashing by now. I've argued this is going to happen, but so far I don't see too many signs of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very difficult situation. We definitely will have to wait and see what happens. Will be something else. Anyway, talking about something that I think is definitely relevant at the conclusion of my monologue, the current trends in American politics indicate a tectonic shift in the electoral landscape, with non-white voters increasingly gravitating towards the Republican Party. While Democrats may still have an opportunity to win back these voters, they must confront the deeper issues driving this realignment and adapt their approach accordingly. Failure to do so risks further erosion of their support base and a fundamental reordering of the political status quo. Now, obviously, I don't want to see the Democrats prosper as a party. I'm not sad to say that they are losing some support among minorities. But just from a purely analytical standpoint, I said what I said. So this is something else. And it was definitely worth bringing up with Paul, considering it's such a vast and deep pool of knowledge about not only American politics, but global politics and the history of both. I think that the realignment taking place will be something that, at the very least, negates some bleeding from college-educated whites, especially women, in some states, particularly the swing states, because, as a matter of fact, college-educated white females have become more solidly Democratic over the Biden administration. They're the only group that has. It's quite remarkable, but you know, not terribly surprising considering the trajectory which that group is on. So I think that that Republicans doing better among minority groups definitely is of great utility, because they'll be able to offset these the loss with college-educated white women. Paul, anything to say about that?
I agree with the college-educated white women. I think it's hopeless. I mean, I've dealt with them for so many years, and issues that you think are going to go away because they've been settled in their favor, like abortion, never goes away because you can't do enough, you know. And you say, well, we'll give you, you're going to have abortion up until the moment the baby comes to the birth canal. Well, you really don't mean it. Or there's some state where we only have abortion rights for 6 weeks or something. But it remains an issue even when the left wins. And I think what it reflects is a sense of resentment, anger, you know, indignation that women were treated differently in the past or something like this. But I think it bodes ill for the future in many ways, because intelligent women, educated women are politically crazy and they're socially crazy. And you know, if you marry them, if you have kids, they're going to raise them the same way. And I can imagine a sane man even wanting to be married to such a person. But it sort of bodes ill for the future of our civilization. There really is no respect for what is viewed as family, or it's interpreted differently. Family values means the right to change your sex surgically, to have unlimited abortion rights at any time you want. To raise your kid and then to change his sex or something. The notion of family values among this group is extremely alarming. And I'm much more concerned about these college-educated women and suburban women than I am about blacks or any other minority, because I think at one point they represented mainstream America. And you know, losing this rule, and particularly since they hold within themselves the power in many ways to determine the future, what Americans are going to look like, you know, in 50 or 100 years, what kind of society we live in. They're the ones who have to, unless you can have kids, you know, born in test tubes or something like that. But I don't know exactly how we undo the harm that the American educational system and the media has inflicted on what at one time would be considered the weaker sex or the more delicate sex, something like that. But I think this is a very serious problem, and I don't know what the solution is.
It's interesting. I always say it's interesting because we discuss so many interesting things on this program. But it is, what I said, interesting, because you could understand why, if college-educated white women were so angry about the past, why they might dislike men or engage in like 1970s feminism. That would make sense in this context. But now it's been expanded to basically these women wanting to disadvantage themselves, which include having a transvestite in their own locker room or in the locker room of their children. So that's just one example, but there are many, many more. So it's like they've taken the women's rights cause to a level that actually injures the cause of biological women, but they don't really seem to care. As a matter of fact, it only seems to make them more fanatical. Paul, any idea why this is? Because like I said, you can understand these women just straight out hated men, whatever, but they take it to a level of self-harm, and I don't see how that benefits their group interests.
Yeah, I actually think that it does begin with what you would consider moderate feminism, because there is very quickly an attempt to show that there is no significant differences between men and women. Now, of course, there are the feminists who, you know, who have some notion of femininity, but it is not traditional femininity that they're defending. But what once you say that making distinctions, gender distinctions, is evil, then this sort of carries you into more extreme positions, like saying, you know, there should be no differences we make between men and women. Genders themselves are mutable. We can just go on changing them because there's nothing permanent, you know, there's nothing permanent about human nature. We can just change anything we want. And to whatever extent you made these social or gender distinctions in the past, you were engaging in injustice. You were violating the principle of equality. So I think once you move along this road, at some point the nuttiness just takes over, and that's what we're seeing right now. I think one can make rational arguments, although I won't agree with them, for the earlier phases of feminism. But we have now is obviously insanity, and it seems to be very hard to. The other thing is that women may be biologically different on the whole from men, and this is the way they react to politics. Right, I mean, in a much more extreme fashion than men do. Mm-hmm. And you know, in Germany in the 1930s, they voted for the Nazis in much larger number than men did. Uh-huh. Now they vote for all kinds of extreme woke nonsense. Again, you know, in much larger numbers than men. And this may be something that is attached to their feminine natures. I don't know, but I do not like the effect that women have had on politics. You know, since certainly since the middle of the last century, I think it's been generally bad. It's put us in a radical direction. And it's, you know, it's resulted in the almost the criminalization of gender distinctions by now.
In some countries, literally the criminalization of it. But yes. it's an insane situation. I don't see it turning around. Although I do think there does have to be some sort of qualification made here, because the women who typically would go to like a 2-year technical college to get mm-hmm. a utilizable degree, that's basically a trade. They're certainly not driving this push towards the left. When we talk about college-educated white women, we're talking about women who, by and large, went to liberal arts, if not a liberal arts school, then they took liberal arts courses at a university or college, and they were driven leftward because of this. I don't think that's it alone, but there is no question that women who are not college, quote-unquote, educated, or women who would get like more of the technical degree, mm-hmm. they do not have the radical politics of the women who get the liberal arts education. And STEM at universities, STEM is sort of a mixed bag. It does produce a lot of woke gals, but it produces some that are apolitical or some that are even conservative. So mm-hmm. You can't generalize about it to the extent that you would generalize about the liberal arts.
No, I think you're correct. I mean, the sort of radicalization of women is more common among liberal arts, and certainly people study gender studies or things like that. Women who go 2 years to college to learn a trade and so forth tend to be more conservative. I would also have to make, you know, a further distinction that, you know, some of the women who are very conservative, whom I know, like Amy Wax, I don't know Marjorie Taylor Greene personally, but she's very conservative. Some of the most outspoken, and in some cases the most intelligent conservatives, are women. So you do have these exceptions. And if women did not have the vote, these people would not be voting. Although many of these people tell me that they see the same thing with women that I'm seeing, right? I mean, there's this sort of kind of emotional excess, and it seems to be particularly common among what Joseph has described as the liberal arts women, right? The ones who go to college and study liberal arts. These are also the most politically prominent women for the most part, culturally and politically prominent, and they do seem to have had, in my view, a pernicious effect on our political culture. And we also see that there is a gender disparity in terms of voting, right? I mean, the men generally vote much more conservatively than women, and also on the social issues. Women are generally the left of men.
Our next discussion will have to be about the, this is throughout the Western world, the growing disconnect between males and females in terms of politics. That, I mean, that's one hell of a discussion, and it's one that we need to have rather soon. But while we're on this, Paul, and as we do move towards wrapping things up, I'm very sorry to say, do you believe that looking at the situation with minorities going GOP, do you think that the Republicans will be able to keep these people post-Trump? Because of, as strange as it might sound, a big reason a lot of these newcomers are in the GOP is because of Trump. He made a space for them where they felt represented or where they felt their views were represented. And so they headed on over. Now, of course, longer standing matters, sociological trends, such as the takeover of the Democrats by college, quote unquote, educated individuals who focus on esoteric, bizarre social issues that repel a lot of minority social sensibilities. That was going on. So these folks becoming more conservative was, one may argue, preordained, regardless of the Donald. But Trump certainly accelerated this trend, just as he accelerated the trend of white college-educated women out of the GOP, but it definitely predated him. So do you think that post-Trump, these people will be able to remain in the GOP in a way that they find satisfactory?
Yeah, I think in the case of the Hispanics, they certainly will. And I think they'll become much more prominent in the GOP. I also don't think it's likely that the GOP will go back to being, you know, the party of Bob Dole and who else was there. I don't know, the Romney, Mitt Romney. I think the populist change, if Trump wins in November, will be irreversible. If he loses, you know, it'll then be an open question whether they want to go back to, you know, to Nikki Haley or Mitt Romney, Republicans of that ilk. But I think if Trump wins, the change is going to be irreversible, and the Republicans will be a working class, a white and Hispanic working class party. It remains to see if the blacks want any part of it, and I am still very skeptical that they're going to join the coalition. I think Asians will. The Republican Party is sort of looking more and more like the Democratic Party when I was a kid. Right? It was made up mostly of blue collar workers, and their descendants are now Republicans, and I think this is going to continue. You can see some of this, by the way, prefigured even in the Buchanan run for the presidency. He didn't go very far, and he represented a very, very conservative Catholic ethic or social ethic, but he definitely had a working class appeal. He appealed to workers, and you know that was his base. And I think we see this in Trump. You know, it's I think late Sam Francis spoke about middle American radicals, and I think that's also you see it's, but it's sort of the unhappy working class that does not see its wages going up, that see other people getting benefits for doing nothing, and which are absolutely infuriated with the open border right now. And we know that this is not an accident, and we know that this is not because there's not bipartisan legislation, bipartisan legislation to amnesty everybody. That's what the Democrats want. We know that this is being done deliberately to create a Democratic majority, and a larger Democratic majority in the U.S. is the only reason it's been done. And it's been done on the backs of American workers. So I think the Democratic Party is going to dig a very deep hole in terms of the working class vote. And I think it'll take a very long time to undo the effects of this, of the inflation, the green energy nonsense, and finally this this gaping open border which the Democratic Party has created.
Do you think that perhaps as minorities become more Republican, even if, you know, there are other minorities who remain Democratic and who radicalize alongside the broader Democratic coalition, do you think that perhaps more minorities voting Republican will create a more harmonious state of race relations, if not across the country, then at least in areas where there are many minority Republicans?
Yeah, it's a question of what comes first, the chicken or the egg. There is less racial divisiveness, there'll be more vote for the Republicans, right? But and if the Republicans win, well, the racial divisiveness, I think, will go down. Because the Democratic Party wins by exploiting racial and gender divisiveness. I mean, this is what it's about. You know, it's like saying that, you know, if the Nazi Party does badly and the other parties would win in Germany, would this reduce the anti-Semitism? Of course it would, you know. I'm making this invidious comparison because I find the Democratic Party loathsome at this point, the kind of stuff it's doing to this country. I think people voting for the Republicans obviously are getting over these racially divisive hangovers, which the Democrats appeal to. But I think the result of Republicans winning might also be good. My one concern is I think the Republican Party is largely unprincipled. And it may start, you know, it may try to use its own race stuff. What you see, by the way, on Fox News, I mean, Mark Levin does this all the time, that, oh, these Southern white Democrats were terrible people. And, you know, the Democrats voted against they voted for the crime bill of 1994, which happened to be a very good bill, which both parties voted for. But, I mean, the Republicans play their own race game, which I find every bit as nauseating, by the way. But I don't think they require this to win in the same way the Democrats do. And I think once they win those minority votes, they're not going to do the same thing. You know, the Democratic Party's brand is, you know, racial divisiveness. The Republicans, in order to win the black vote, say very stupid things. But I don't think they are committed to racial divisiveness.
It is something else, to say the absolute least. Their state of race relations in America, it's interesting because obviously it's racial differences are becoming less of a thing, but at the same time, there is a sort of racial consciousness which is definitely used by the left to malign the right at every turn, you know, being racist, quote unquote Nazis, this, that, the other thing. So it's something. And of course, what's unique is that in America, somebody can consider a minority to have blonde hair and blue eyes, we'll just say if they are, if their ancestors were from Spain, but they were born in Colombia, or maybe if they have 1/16th Cherokee ancestry or something like that. But people who are much much darker complexion are considered white, which definitely would be me along with many, many others who fall under that. Even during the days of Jim Crow, Uncle Sam considered all four of my grandparents to be white, and two of them were from the West Indies, and one of them had a very olive complexion, looking stereotypically Middle Eastern, North African, whatever. It's unique, the whole racial thing in America and how it functions. It's definitely an enigma wrapped in. It's something that can hardly be put into words. But there it is, and there are political consequences to it, and we're dealing with those right now. So, Paul, as we wrap this up now at long last, do you believe that the Republicans will be able to capitalize on the minority shift towards them in a way that makes it substantially likelier that Donald Trump at least carries the Electoral College?
Yeah, I think he can win. I think if it's a fair election, which it may well not be, and the Democrats can cheat and have the media behind them. But if the election is a fair election, and, you know, I take my cue from Patrick Basham and from others I've communicated with at Democracy. And was it what is the one in Atlanta, the Republican?
That's Trafalgar in Atlanta. Trafalgar. Patrick Basham is Democracy Institute.
Yeah, I mean, they argue it's a fair election. Trump should win. I don't know if he'll win by. I think he might even win the popular vote, despite California, New York, and some of these other places where the Democrats win by enormous pluralities. But I think he might win the popular vote as well in an honest election. There's one point I did not make in my my comments, which I think are important because they sort of reflected my scholarship. I don't think blacks really benefit from any of this. Racial divisiveness, the appeal to their victim status, the beating up on white racism. The ones who benefit are white elites who keep power, you know, by using these people and also use them to punish other white people whom they look down at, you know, the ones who are living in flyover country or the ones who go to, you know, Pentecostal churches or something like that, people they don't like, whom they look down at socially. And they do fine. I don't think blacks get very much out of this except an opportunity to vent their anger on the whites, which I think is the major benefit that they're getting from being Democrats, if one can describe that as a benefit. But I think Trump may win. I think at least some of it depends on what the Democrats do to him. I think if Letitia James takes away his property in New York State, I have no doubt he'll win the presidency. Because it is, unless you are absolutely blind, it is obvious that this is unjust warfare and violation of the Eighth Amendment, which is being waged by Democrats against Trump. And it is so unfair. It is morally and every way unjustified. And I think even, you know, even the independents, I think, are going to have to see this. So I in many ways, I hope she pulls away his property because he's going to win. There are, of course, there are Americans who think it's a great thing and she should do this to him. And many of them are black, you know, who voted for Letitia James, you know, if she could do this. But I think most people will see this as unjust. This the same way that all the lawfare that has been used against him until now has actually redounded to Trump's benefit.
Yes, the lawfare has benefited him, at least politically, but obviously it's a hindrance otherwise. But it definitely has worked to his benefit in keeping him in the news, in the sense of not being someone who's causing problems, rather someone who's the victim of his opponents, who are really, really out to get him. You know, his opponents, they've just not seen the rewards of their of their behavior, justifiably so, obviously, from my point of view, because what they're doing definitely does not deserve to be rewarded, and that's putting it far too mildly. Paul, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. It's been a great conversation.
Yes, it has. Very frank, open conversation, and I thought also a very knowledgeable one. I liked your... What do you call it, your talking points or whatever?
My monologue. Yeah.
Your monologue, right?
And of course, I very much liked your perspectives on my monologue. It's far more interesting than what I have to say. But anyway, everyone, thank you very much for stopping by. I hope you found this chat to be as intriguing as Paul and I did. I hope to have Paul on the show again soon. I like to have him on once a month because it's just been too long since we had our last conversation. Okay. There's so much stuff to discuss. Next time around, it's going to be this gender gap in Western countries, wherein the women are obviously veering towards the left and men are veering towards the right. That creates a very interesting, I put it a bit facetiously, but a very interesting state of affairs. One might say destructive, turbulent, and there's a lot more, but I don't want to get into the next episode just now. So everyone, thank you very much. Stay safe, be well, and... cheers.